Hello and welcome to episode 18 of Meenal's World. Thank you to everybody who's been sending in all your messages of love and support and best wishes really for the delivery of our baby, which should happen well soon, I guess, and I hope as well. I can't wait to get this baby out, to be honest. I mean, the 9 months have been very strange and odd because I never thought my pregnancy would be this way, and I think trying to cope with the pregnancy, trying to cope with the pandemic, trying to cope with my job, it's been very weird to sort of learn how to balance all of these emotions. And I've been quite outspoken on Twitter. I've been very clear on Instagram as well that the learning curve has been an incredible journey, which is something I still think I need to sort of absorb and reflect back on. And I'm trying to share everything I'm learning with you guys as well, especially on Instagram when I talk about the books I read every week and the articles and the podcasts I'm tuning into, just so that we can all learn together and grow together. I think that's really important. I think my biggest worry and my biggest fear is that we will forget this all ever happened. And it's very easy to do that when lockdown finishes and most countries go back to normal and we are just trying to get back to our lives where likes are important or posting flowery photos are important. But as I said, I think I was very clear a few days ago on Instagram when I said that if you don't want to follow me to actually learn and grow within this community together, then I'm happy to just have 2 followers rather than having 20,000 followers and keep up appearances, because honestly, that's just too exhausting. Doesn't come naturally to me, and it just doesn't sit well with me. So hopefully in the next few weeks I can get a momentum going, I can get my schedule a bit more in line with what I want to achieve, because I think I would assume that having a baby would mean that you have to get your shit together. So I kind of have to sort of make sure that I make time for the right things at the right time. I think lockdown has made me quite lazy, to be honest. And I think lockdown has meant that I just sort of somehow believe that I have plenty of time, and then I realize that it's Friday and I haven't released my episode. So here we are today, and I have Krina on the other side, whose story really sparked an interest, because in my first episode where I spoke to Ravine spoke about fertility treatment and IVF treatment, and she did mention that these are these are topics that are not really spoken about in our community, and Karina's journey has been very similar. Now, unfortunately, we have to divide this interview into 2 parts because it's very deep, it's very intense. I think I had to actually put a stop to it and put a pause to it and say, look, we have to come back, because I don't think it's fair to Karina's story, and I don't think it's fair to you listeners to have her story condensed in a very short episode. So this will be a 2-part episode, and this is the first one. The second one hopefully will come out in the next week or so. So I hope you enjoy this, and I hope the story gives you strength and it inspires you just like it did with me. So without further ado, it's Karina. Welcome to the show, Karina. I'm so glad to finally get in touch with you and have this chat. I know we've been up and down for some time. Even though it's been COVID, even though we've been in lockdown technically, for some reason we've been too busy.
I know. It's mad, isn't it?
There's always something coming up. But Karina, I actually found you I've been following you on Instagram for some time. And it was only recently where I started to understand more about your story, because you've been, you know, speaking up about lots of different issues surrounding your journey. And one of the reasons I found it very interesting especially was because my first guest was Ravine Sethi, who's going through her own treatment at the moment regarding her lymphoma, and she talks about fertility as well, and she feels that it's something that as women we don't speak enough about in our community. And that's something that obviously you talk about quite a lot as well. So I thought it'd be really interesting to talk to you in that regard, but also in the regards of you're also expecting new arrivals in your family as well, but in a different way, through different means. And I wanted to just, you know, understand what that's like, because for me as a pregnant woman, I'm going through it, what we could say, the traditional way, where I have my baby and you know, and it hasn't been traditional in the sense that it's been COVID and it's been quite like strange really to be pregnant during this time. But I'm sure from your angle as well, it must have been a whole different story. But we'll talk about all of that, Karina. There's a lot to get through today. But first, my question is, Karina, and I always been asking the guests throughout the pandemic, how have you found the last few months?
Gosh, I think like most people there, it's been up and down. There's been, you know, beautiful moments, and then there's equally really frustrating times. So myself, my husband and my little one, we've been shielding. I guess we'll get into this later, but I have a heart condition. And so it was, you know, when COVID first hit and there was a vulnerability for people with cardiac conditions, it really freaked us out. And we haven't come this far since, you know, the days that I was diagnosed with breast cancer to then have COVID throw our world upside down again. So we've been incredibly cautious because we just don't want any more bad news in our family. So, you know, we've been at home, and we actually were shielding, we were self-isolating before the government put everyone into lockdown. So I actually work in Brighton, which isn't a million miles. Well, I work in Hove, sorry, which isn't far from Brighton, where the very first cases were being reported. And there was a lot of chat about this at work in the office. And we were asked if we felt comfortable to still go into the office, knowing that this virus was in the area. And I quite early on said no, and, you know, set myself up to work from home. I'm lucky that I can do that anyway, quite seamlessly. My husband was then home-based as well, and we pulled my little one out of nursery. So we've kind of been here since the end of February. And, you know, wow. It's getting really difficult now. Just because, you know, we're missing that social contact and interaction with other
people. I know, Karina. I feel the exact same way. I mean, I have been quite busy protesting and, you know, doing all some fun stuff, you could say. Yeah. But, you know, we've launched our legal challenge as well with the government. So that's kept me quite busy and quite occupied, and it's given me something to do. But it's only now where I'm approaching, well, the delivery date, and my parents have managed to fly over, that I've actually realized how important that social contact is, how much I actually missed family, how much I missed having that contact, because it's been very, very difficult to maintain that pace of life from home. And I'm sure it's even more difficult with a little one as well. How old is your daughter?
She's two. And it is difficult. And it's an age at which they love the company of other children. So, you know, we feel guilty for taking her out of nursery. It wasn't an easy decision to make, but it was the right decision for us. And I guess the flip side is we've had family time like we've never had before. So, you know, to have the three of us at home and to just watch her grow, and you know, it's been really lovely to have really quality time where you're not being pulled by this person's kid's birthday or this person's wedding or this you know, every weekend's been free, so and every day's felt like a weekend.
You're just winging it as you go along.
Yeah, we're just kind of getting through it, and you know, we're starting to go out more now, but my mum has COPD, and I'm a primary carer for her, so again, really cautious with where we go and what we do. So I can't see life changing much for us over the coming months, but
I think it will be a slow introduction back into society, especially you know, for someone like yourself. You said that you have to shield, and I think your protection should come first more than anything else. But Karina, you mentioned that you have a heart condition, but if we just go back to the very start, You mentioned that you also had breast cancer. Just a quick question before we go into the cancer. Was the heart failure a result of the breast cancer treatment? So when were you diagnosed with the breast cancer?
So I was diagnosed with breast cancer in October 2013. I was okay. 33.
And was that was that through like routine checkups? Or?
No. So what had happened was my nipple inverted. I didn't know it was a sign of cancer at all. I left it for weeks. And then my husband at one point said, you probably should go to a doctor because that doesn't look right. And as soon as he sort of expressed concern, it worried me because he's normally a really chilled out guy. So for him to think I should go to the doctor, I was like, wow, maybe I should take this a little bit seriously. I did what you're not meant to do, and it was a weekend. So I went on the internet and I Googled what's an inverted nipple. And, you know, it was anything I looked at just said it was a sign of breast cancer. And the more I looked at it, I thought, my God, this could be cancer, because I was then reading other symptoms and thinking, well, I have had shooting pains and I have had some, you know, dimpling in my boob, but I haven't really taken much concern over. And the more I looked at it, the more I thought, okay, I need to get this looked at. So I called the GP and I just said, look, I'm really worried. I've got this inverted nipple. I don't know what it is. At this point, I couldn't feel a lump or anything like that. So the conventional thing that we all look for wasn't there, but the GP wasn't as concerned as I was and just said, you know, book the next routine appointment, you'll be fine. It was a couple of weeks before I could get in. And then when I did get in, was dismissed really with my symptoms. So I showed it to the doctor who was there, and she just said, well, you're 33, you haven't had babies, you've probably got a blocked milk duct, and I'm not too concerned. She examined the area and then said, well, you know, come back if it doesn't resolve itself in a month or so. But because I'd been Googling it so much and I was so afraid, I just said to her, I can't leave here without a referral because I'm really anxious and I just can't wait a month. I think, you know, there might be something seriously wrong with me, and sort of forced her to make that referral. She just kept saying to me, well, your tissue is going to be too dense for a mammogram. It's not going to be worth doing. And we sort of had a really heated discussion about it, which is frustrating, but eventually got the referral.
Why do you think she was so reluctant to investigate further?
I don't know, but I hear it so much with young women who are just, you know, because they're not postmenopausal, and they're not, you know, she herself said she couldn't feel a lump, so maybe she didn't really think it could be breast cancer. I don't know. I don't know what her thoughts were. I just knew that I was quite consumed with fear and needed to get a second opinion. And I'm very, very glad that I did, you know.
And was you, before you got into the specific checkup, after you noticed this specific symptom, were you getting regular checkups that they do?
So there aren't any regular checkups over here, right? So
no, it would be after, probably, yeah, because you were 33, weren't you? Yeah, at that time, weren't you? Yeah, so it'd probably be after that. Yeah,
so there was nothing
in place. No, like a screening, breast screening.
Yeah, so there's no breast screening at that age. Over here.
So do you have any family history of?
So this is a thing. My mum's mum actually had breast cancer twice. In both breasts, right. But we just didn't talk about it as a family, and I was quite young, well, not young, but I was just not in that space where I considered people's health. That, you know, when she was suffering with it, she's passed away. It's been over 10 years since she's passed away, so I just didn't, it never registered that she had breast cancer, so it never, I just didn't think it would happen to me. And when it did, I just thought, well, and this is why I speak about it, I think, God, it was in my family and I still wasn't aware of the symptoms, and that's nuts. Like, as a community, we need to be so much more aware and we need to know what the symptoms are, so we're diagnosed earlier and our prognosis is so much better, because actually, you know, I should have been at the doctors way before I got there.
Well, Karina, you're talking about breast cancer, which is something that's so an intense conversation, right? It's not something you would just have over a cup of tea. It's quite an intense conversation to go into. I'm about to have my baby in the next few days, in the next week or so. I'm too afraid to talk to my mom about breastfeeding.
Yeah,
feel uncomfortable, like, to talk to my mom. I mean, just yesterday, I have the box of the electrical breast pump.
Yeah,
I can't figure it out. But I'm too shy to ask my mom.
Yeah.
We don't have that. We've never had conversations like that.
No.
And even with my husband a few days ago, I was like, well, if I want to breastfeed, do I breastfeed in front of my mom? Or do I come upstairs and be in a private area? Will it make her uncomfortable? It's more about her like feeling uncomfortable, because
we're trying to protect them, aren't we? But actually, in doing that, we're doing the total opposite, really, because
a conversation that needs to be had.
We have to normalize it, and I totally get it, that generation's been brought up very differently to us, and for them they find it difficult to approach subjects like this. So I really think that actually this role of educating, and you know, whether it is, like you say, just knowing, you know, having a conversation about breastfeeding, or whether it's the other end of the spectrum and talking about cancer and the signs and symptoms, I think all the responsibility sits with our generation now, because we're definitely, you know, we're mothers, we're informed, we've got this life where we're really, you know, we're educated, and we can open up that conversation, and we can make our elders feel comfortable in that space. Whereas I think it'd be very difficult for them to start speaking about it to us. So actually, I almost feel like it's our duty to take this and educate them on what they should be looking for in their own breasts, you know, in their own breast health and stuff. So, I'm so passionate about it, because I just don't think that we should be part of this community that can't talk about things, because at the end of the day, that could save someone's life.
Mm, I agree. And at that time, Karina, were you married at that time? You said your husband had. Yeah. And how long were you married for?
So we'd been married for 3 years at that point. Mm.
And you were planning to start a family at that time?
Yeah, we were. We'd been married for 3 years. We'd sort of, the first year is always a settling in sort of period, isn't it? And then the second year after our marriage, we had decided to travel the world. So we quit our bags, quit our jobs, packed our bags, and we just got on a plane and went around the world backpacking. Mm. So we had an amazing adventure. And then we came back and we found our jobs, and, you know, we were settling into life. And then the next thing really was to consider starting a family. And just as we were sort of thinking about and having those conversations, things just took a real turn for the worst for us.
Yeah, and when you went to the GP, when your doctor just to the first time and explained everything, and she still was reluctant to investigate further, at that point, did you decide to go privately, or did you continue through the NHS?
I was actually still being seen through the NHS. Had I not got that referral, I think I probably would have pushed for a private consultation. But because she referred me to the breast screening clinic, I just went and continued on that journey.
Yeah.
As soon as I...
Go on. Yeah, sorry. I was just saying, because when I spoke to Ravine in my first episode, she said that she went through the NHS. They were looking at her skin, and they thought it was like scabies. And she even like decarpeted the whole house, because that's what she thought it was. And then I think through some health insurance, she said, okay, look, I'm just going to go privately and sort it out. And from diagnosis to treatment, everything was just boom, 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 quick, quick, quick.
Yeah.
But not everyone has that advantage. Not everyone can do that.
Yeah,
especially
I mean,
in the UK.
Yeah, the irony is that I did have private healthcare, but I didn't think to use it. So I waited a very long time. So before I saw my GP, I had waited about 2.5 weeks before that appointment, and then I was waiting another 2 weeks before I saw the consultant. So from the point at which I was starting to think this is something to worry about, I probably had 6 weeks or so before seeing a breast specialist.
When you were diagnosed, what kind of conversations were you having with your husband at this point?
By the diagnosis day, I was quite sure that of what it was that I was dealing with, because what came in between that period was I saw a consultant. She said that she could feel something in my lump. She made it very clear that she was really concerned. She tried to get me a mammogram and a biopsy immediately. And as soon as I saw her sort of running down the corridors, I thought, God, this can't be good news. And then because my results had come in, I was called on a Monday, having been to a biopsy on a Friday, there's not even one working day in between that. And the lady just said to me, you need to see the consultant. And by that point I was like, well, this is definitely cancer, because no one would turn results around that quickly and get me into clinic that quickly if it wasn't bad news. So I was ready for it. I think my husband was very much in denial, and he didn't want to believe it, even though I'd been going through the tests and stuff. He just didn't want to believe it. So he kept saying to me, it's nothing to worry about. I don't want you to worry. It's nothing to worry about. And then we sat down in this, you know, in this consultation room with a breast specialist, and he just confirmed that it was breast cancer. And I didn't really have much emotion at that time. I was just ready to for him to tell me what I needed to do. But my husband was broke down in tears, you know, and I've very rarely seen him cry. So it just showed how much he was bottling up, you know, all of this emotion and fear and anxiety, and just, you know, the words that confirmed you have breast cancer meant that it all came pouring out for him. And that was a horrible moment for me, because I just thought, well, I've done that. Like, you know, I sort of had this period of which I thought, well, this is my fault now. I'm bringing this into everyone's lives, and it's going to affect all of us, and no one signed up for this.
And what about the rest of your family? How did, like, your mom and everybody else, what was their reaction?
It was such a difficult time. My mum and I have a very, very close. My mum has had, you know, a lot of struggle in her own life, and we had got to this point at which I got married, and my mum had divorced my dad, and we'd sort of had to buy our own house, and we'd set up by ourselves, her and I, and we were a bit like, we were just each other's, you know, each other's best friends, but each other's support as well. And I knew that my mum leaned on me a lot because she had so much going on. So I found it very difficult to have that conversation with her, and I chose not to have it until the very end. So the first person I told was actually my Masi. So my mum's younger sister, who I'm very close to, we got the diagnosis, and I just said to Sati, look, we need to go and tell them first. I just wanted to tell my Masi and Masa. So I went there and I told them. And it's that thing, we'd been married for 3 years, and you know, you turn up at someone's house unexpected, and they just, you know, we went upstairs to make a cup of tea, and I said, oh, I've got something to tell you. And she just thought I was going to tell her I was pregnant, and she was so excited, you know. And she said it, she goes, oh, you're pregnant, aren't you? And I just looked at her and I was like, I wish that was what I was here to tell you, but I'm not, you know, quite the opposite. I've got breast cancer. And she just kept saying, I don't believe it, I can't, you know, why you was always a question that came up. And then I don't believe it, and just disbelief really was always the first sort of emotion that came over. But then it was always support, you know, so I never felt like anyone from my family was going to turn their back on me. So when I told her, she just gave me advice. She goes, okay, right, if this is what's happening, you know, we've got to just deal with it. And we had conversations around, she was actually the one who first had me open my eyes to the fertility preservation stuff. So we had some conversations about that over the weeks that passed. And then I told my cousins after my Masi, and they were all very, my cousins and my sister, and they were all very practical. So they were like, right, what do we need to do? What steps do we need to take? Who needs to look after you? What hospital are you going to choose to be treated at? By this point, the penny dropped that I had private healthcare. So my options opened up as to what I wanted for treatment and where I wanted to be treated. So I was like, just talking to them about where I wanted to have treatment. And we were having conversations about the hospitals that were in our area, et cetera. And then the last conversation was with my mum. And I took my sister with me to that one. And I sort of briefed her before, saying, look, I don't want to really dwell on it when I'm telling mum. I just want to sort of be very matter of fact, say what it is. And then I'm going to have to leave you to pick up the pieces, because I haven't got the energy to support her right now. I just need to look after myself. So we went there, and it had been her birthday a couple of days prior, so she thought we were gonna just catch up over cake and tea and stuff. And we just sat down, and I just said to her, oh, you know I haven't been around much and I've been really busy. And she just said, oh, I know, work's busy, don't worry about it. And I said, oh, it's not that, I just need to tell you that I've got breast cancer. And she was so shocked, she couldn't believe it. I think she was probably upset that I hadn't told her before, and I'd been going through all the testing on my own. You know, I hadn't told anyone apart from my husband until the day I was diagnosed. No one knew what we were sort of dealing with. And we sat and we talked. And again, she said, you know, why you? It's not fair. What have you done to deserve this? And I wasn't ready for those questions, and no one had the answers. So I just couldn't really deal with it, and, you know, just sort of removed myself. And then went off on the next sort of part of this crazy journey, which was speaking to an oncologist and putting a treatment plan in place.
So when you were diagnosed, Karina, did you have when your biopsy came back, what stage were you diagnosed with?
Stage 3.
Stage 3. And what was your treatment plan from there? I mean, what did the doctor tell you that? Did the doctor tell you that, okay, we're going to give you chemotherapy and this is
the outcome we expect? So no, well, initially on my first consultation, when I was diagnosed, his view was that we could hopefully, the tumor was very close to the nipple area. So he was hoping that it hadn't got anywhere near the chest wall. And so his plan was, we'll remove the breast and then hopefully just deliver radiotherapy to the chest. And that would be it for treatment. So at this point, I was sort of really grateful that I didn't need to have chemotherapy because that was just, you know, that was just something I wasn't ready for in any way. So I'd sort of gone off thinking I'm only going to have radiotherapy. And then we got to the day of my mastectomy and I had the surgery. And 3 days after that surgery, I was back in clinic to talk about the results from that op. And he said to me, look, we found a lot more cancer than we thought was going to be in your breast. There was actually 2 large tumors. So one tumor was 6 centimeters in size. The second tumor was nearly 3 centimeters in size. So I only have a C-cup boob. So there was 9 centimeters worth of tumors in my breast. And then he had taken lymph nodes out and he had found that they were also marked. So he said, look, your lymph nodes have got tumors in them. Your breast has got more tumors than we thought. We're going to have to remove all of your lymph nodes and your treatment plan is going to have to change and you're going to have chemotherapy now because this is more progressed than we thought it was. And it was that day that I felt everything came crashing down for me because up until then, in between this, I'd even gone to work and said to my boss, you know, oh yeah, I've got cancer, but it's fine. I'm only going to have radiotherapy and I'll be back at work within 3 months. Don't worry about it. You know, I was so blasé and flippant about it. And then, you know, chemotherapy, you just know, it's going to be so much more aggressive and you know, you lose all control. I knew that my hair was going to fall out, you know, and that was, I think as an Indian woman, that was just so difficult for me to even embrace or contemplate. I just couldn't think about me being bald because, you know, my mom, our whole lives, my mom had been like, don't cut your hair, your hair's your beauty. And you know, you oil your hair and your hair is this sign of beauty in the Indian culture. And I was like, I'm gonna lose all that and I'm just not ready for it. And as soon as I lose all that hair and I lose and like the visual effects of cancer start to take hold, everyone's going to know what I'm going through. And I wasn't at this point sharing my journey at all. I was so ashamed and embarrassed and upset that this had happened to me. I, you know, I was this sort of rock and people always used to say I was my mum's son because, you know, I was like the man in our household and I held everything together and, you know, I got a career that was sort of paying really well. So we had a nice house and all of those things that we're sort of conditioned to do, as in, you know.
But it's a very normal thing, Karina. Even right now, as a daughter, my parents are with me and I'm going to be a mother now.
Yeah.
But I'm not even thinking about, oh, I'll be tired after the pregnancy or I'll be tired. I'm like, I just hope my parents can have a good time with their grandchild. It's just in our system to make sure that our parents are happy. And I think that there's nothing wrong with that, actually. There's nothing wrong with that. But I think there has to be a balance, right? We have to just remember that, okay, it's okay to think about ourselves sometimes.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and the one thing
and
that
our moms and dads.
Yeah, like the one thing I've learned over the years is that you can't love anyone else without self-love, right? Because your cup will be empty. And the problem is that we're brought up in this environment where we know our parents have struggled, right? To get to where we are today, our parents have struggled. And so we feel indebted to them. We feel like we owe them. And we take it a step further to think that we have to take away all of their pain and, you know, we have to be responsible for them now. And that even if that comes at our own expense, it's fine. And that was definitely how I felt. Like I felt like, you know, my mum was now this, you know, divorcee, we were living in this house, I just got married and I was now going to throw everything that we'd worked towards just in the bit. It felt like I was just you know, a letdown, really. And it's taken a lot of personal development for me to overcome that and to realize that actually that's just a function of conditioning, and it's not right to feel that way. And, you know, we sort of have to raise a generation who don't feel like that, because I don't think it's particularly healthy for anyone.
And at what point, Karina, did the conversation of fertility treatment come in during your journey?
So it was after I'd had my mastectomy. I'd had a few weeks to recover from that surgery, and then was due to see the oncologist that I had chosen to be treated with at the Royal Marsden. So I went in for my very first appointment with him, and he said to me, this is the treatment, you know. I was seeing him privately. So he said to me, we've got two choices when it comes to your treatment. You can follow the NHS protocol, which is they sort of follow European protocol, or privately I can do what I think is right, and I would prefer to follow a US protocol, which is a slightly different form of chemotherapy and a slightly different doses. But that's, if you ask me which one, that's the one I would tell you to do, because that's the one I would choose to prescribe you, but it's your choice. And I said, well, obviously I'm going to do what you tell me to do. So if I've got a choice to have the US regime, I will have it, which I did because of my private healthcare. So we started talking about chemotherapy, and he started talking about the effect that those drugs would have on me. And then he just said, you know, I know you're newlywed, and I wonder if you had any plans for children. And in between this, my Massey and I had been having conversations about fertility and, you know, how I definitely wanted to have children if I outlived cancer. And I didn't want to be finding myself infertile after chemotherapy. So I said to him, look, I've been thinking about this, and I know I want kids, you know, I want to get through this, and I want to get, you know, I want to get my life back, and I want to be a mum. And he said, well, you've got two options. I can give you an injection to put your ovaries to sleep, which will hopefully protect them from the chemotherapy and preserve your fertility. And that was kind of the option he really wanted me to take. So he was like, you know, it's a good option, and I think you'll be okay on it. And I just said, but you can't guarantee that I'll be okay, can you? Because I had turned 34 by then. So I was like, I'm now 34. You know, you're telling me I wouldn't really be able to think about a baby for 3 years plus, then I'll be closer to 40. So, you know, how do we know that by the time I'm, you know, 38 odd, we haven't got beyond the point of me having a child naturally anyway? We just won't know. It's so far in the future. And he goes, there's no guarantees. And I just said to him, look, can I not just do IVF before chemotherapy? Like, that would be what I want to do, because I would rather know now what my options are than be living in quandary and for the next 3 or 4 years. And he said to me, he just turned around and he said, Karina, you know, my job is to save your life, not to create a new life. And, you know, it's not going to be the easiest thing to do, to put you through IVF now. You have got a tumor that is hormonally sensitive to estrogen and progesterone. And then to go through IVF, you're going to have to inject yourself with estrogen. You know, you're going to introduce hormones into your body, and it's risky. And then Satty and I had a conversation, and we just felt like this was the right thing to do. Like, I just wanted to do it. And I said, look, if it can be done, you know, and if you have a way of mitigating risk, this is my preferred option. And he was great. He just said, look, if that's what you want to do, then you've just got to do it. But like, it was the 8th of October or something like that. And he goes, by the end of the month, I need you in a chemo chair. Like, you literally have the next 2 weeks to do this, and that's it. So we went off, and he made a referral to Barts Hospital, where he had someone who was working in reproductive medicine, and just said, look, I need this woman treated ASAP. I was quite fortunate, I guess. My period had just started. The day after that appointment, my period started. So the first day I saw my consultant at Barts Hospital, I had just started my period, and she said, oh, we need day one of your cycle before we can start planning your IVF drugs and stuff. And I said, oh, well, today's day one. And she goes, well, the timing couldn't be better, because, you know, you've got to get this done within 14 days, and I need 14 days to get your body ready for egg retrieval. So we went on that journey, and we spoke about what I would have to undergo to stimulate my follicles and then to collect eggs. And it was like, it was so, to me, that wasn't, there was no real love there. Like, I know some people go into IVF as, you know, they just want a baby and they'll put all of their heart and soul into it. And for me, it was like, I'm doing this as part of cancer treatment. It was just something I had to do. It wasn't.
But wasn't there, because you were at that time in your life where you were planning to have a child anyway, and you were thinking about your family, was that not there then, that, okay, this can actually be part of my plan now?
No, because I was so overshadowed by whether I would live or not, whether I'd live or die. Like, I just couldn't get my head out of whether this cancer was going to kill me and whether I was just wasting my time.
So you couldn't really see beyond that, yeah.
No, it was, you know, at that point in my life, everything was about cancer.
And what were conversations with, like, your mother and your mussy like and your family like regarding fertility treatment?
I didn't talk about it much. I just told them what I was doing, you know. Like, I just made my decision. And then I'm really one of those people who once I get it in my head what I want to do, I just have to focus on it without too much sort of outside interference or without getting other people's opinions and stuff. I just sort of thought, well, I know what I want to do. This is what we need to do. We just need to get on and get it done, because no one's going to be able to change anything. No one can undo where we're at. And I don't want to, I just didn't want to bring in any other energy. I just needed it to be me and Sati just getting on with it,
just getting it done.
Yeah. So that's
so what you we did. you went through this process, and I mean, was the specific process that you're talking about, was this successful to bring you your daughter right now?
So yes, so we collected the eggs, we fertilized them, and then they were frozen at day one. So that the first day after fertilization, they were put in the freezer. And then it was like, they're just parked there until we get through cancer and we get to a point at which we would one day be able to use them. And I think for a little while, I didn't really think about them, because like I said, they were just a process, and I was still in this position of, will I live through cancer or not? You know, I'd had conversations about the statistics around my prognosis, and my oncologist, you know, he didn't want to share stats with me, but he did. And the prognosis was that I was unlikely to, if there was going to be a recurrence, it would be very highly likely to happen within the first 3 years of my initial diagnosis. So I found it really difficult to think about having a family at that point, because I was so afraid of a cancer recurrence. And, you know,
So is that why, so you froze them and you were just waiting to see how you would be at the end of your treatment, and then you could go back to that fertilized embryo to see, we want to continue with this now. Okay.
Exactly.
And that. So when you, what was the time difference between the time you fertilized, froze the embryo to when you decided to continue with it?
So the embryo was frozen in 2013. I didn't use it until 2017.
Wow, so for 5 years.
Yeah, it was 4.5 years before we used it. But obviously in between that time, what had happened is I'd got through my treatment. I ended up having more surgery and stuff. And then in 2016, just as I was recovering and really thinking about the future, we'd gone on a holiday, and I found myself falling very unwell very quickly. I ended up being taken into A&E. From there, I was taken into ICU and diagnosed with acute heart failure. And that was something that happened, you know, it later transpired that that was a secondary effect of chemotherapy. So the drug, one of the drugs that I'd been given, epirubicin, I didn't know this, but was cardiotoxic, and it had poisoned my heart. And I didn't realize it until, you know, I wound up in this hospital in Vancouver, you know, rigged up to so many machines. We were told that I wouldn't make it through, that we should make provision to say our goodbyes.
Oh, wow.
And that, you know, that this was probably where life would end for me. And it was very difficult. We were so far away from anyone we loved and everyone we knew. And my sister flew out to Vancouver as soon as she found out, just to be with us in case I didn't make it through. I recorded my goodbyes on my phone so that, you know, if I had to say goodbye to my mom, it was there, because she wouldn't have seen me. It was so dark. The time was very difficult for us. But I had this weird sort of, once I'd sort of regained consciousness, and, you know, they were still saying I was very, very sick and very critical, I sort of had this this sort of most gut feel that I was going to make it through. And, you know, regardless of what they were saying, I knew that I knew I would get through it. Once I got through sort of 24 to 48 hours, I was like, right, this isn't going to kill me now. I know I can beat it, and I know I can recover from it. So my sort of my focus changed, and I was really, I don't know, all I could do was see a future, you know. And it was weird because when I was in cancer, I couldn't see a future. But when I was in heart failure, which was almost more life threatening, all I focused on was the future. And in between sort of my initial diagnosis and the heart failure diagnosis, I'd been thinking about motherhood anyway, and I'd been thinking about these embryos and what I would do to bring them to life. And I'd been back to my oncologist and spoken to him about carrying a pregnancy. And he just said to me at that point, he goes, I just think it's still too high risk for you, given your prognosis. I wouldn't advise it for at least another 2 years. And I didn't want to wait that long. So I started looking into surrogacy and thinking, look, if I wait for as long as he tells me to wait for, I'm going to be approaching 40. And then I probably have other risks and complications when it comes to carrying a baby anyway. So shall I surrender that and look for alternatives? And so I started sort of looking into the world of surrogacy and what my options were. And I was very much already part of the surrogacy community when heart failure happened. So I'd been in forums and chat rooms and getting to know people. And then heart failure happened, and I came back from Vancouver eventually to see a cardiologist, and he said to me, I just wanted to let you know, I know you're young and I know you're married and you probably want kids one day, but you can't, you won't be able to carry a baby with your heart health and with the medication you have to stay on to keep you alive. It's, you know, that it would be toxic to a child, a fetus. So he kind of, you know, between him and the cardiologist and my oncologist, they both made it very clear that pregnancy wasn't something that I could do. And as a result, we sort of really pursued the surrogacy option. And it was actually gone.
Now, I was going to ask you, Karina, sorry to interrupt you, but I want to ask, what are the options available for surrogacy through the NHS? Because that's something I haven't actually looked into, and I'm just interested to know what kind of services they offer.
So they don't. So you can't do surrogacy through the NHS.
Right. And there's nothing, no support.
No, no. And that the reason for that is because in the UK, there's no law to protect surrogacy. So it's legal. You can do it, but you don't have a legal framework to support you if it goes wrong. So I think from the NHS's perspective, they can't be seen to be funding something that isn't legally recognized in, you know,
right.
that if, I don't know, if someone changed their mind or whatever, that the courts wouldn't have the ability to grant in one person's favor or not, and it'd be really muddy for the NHS to get involved in funding that sort of treatment. So
but what was it like at that time to know? Because I mean, to go through a pregnancy, right, Karina, you as a woman, you think, okay, I will go through these changes in my body, my bump will grow, people will see my bump grow, I'll feel the baby kick, I'll feel the baby move, and these are the nice things, Karina. I mean, I was vomiting for like a good 4 months, so it's not that nice for some periods. But you know, there are things that allow the mother at least to connect to the child in that way.
Yeah.
So you knew that when you're going into surrogacy, you personally would miss out on that because it's something that you wouldn't be able to feel.
Yeah.
Was that something that crossed your mind at that time, or were you just like, look, I just want to have my child?
No,
and then it came out later.
No, it was there from the beginning. You know, that was, and actually, it probably started even before the choice of surrogacy. It started from the point at which I was put into an early menopause for my cancer treatment. So, I was put. You know, I was 34 and I was in menopause. I was 35. I'd lost both my breasts. There was so much femininity stolen from me in what should be the prime of my life, and I struggle, you know, and I still struggle with it. It really upsets me that I never really have enjoyed that sort of, you know, vibrant young married woman who's beautiful and who thinks her body is, you know, whose body is incredible. And I'm not saying I know my body is absolutely incredible, but not in the way that I thought it would be. So I wasn't able to do the things I wanted to do, and you know, I wasn't like I said before we even joined this call, you know, I'm just hot flushing left, right and center, and I've got issues with my bone density, and I almost have the body of like a 60 something year old, but I'm a vibrant 40 year old. And it was a really difficult time for me. And I would even question why my husband stayed with me. I'm like, well, he's going to be like, well, look at, you know, her body's all been chopped up, and, you know, she's not able to carry my child anymore. She's not able to do
that. But that's because, Karina, our upbringing and our society and our community kind of defines womanhood through marriage
and being a mother and childbirth.
And even Karina now, it's quite funny because I was given the option to have my labor induced at 39 weeks, right?
Mm.
And I mean, I'm strong, I'm brave, I'm all of that. I know I am, because I've done things before in my life which have required those characteristics.
Yeah.
But when they said to me, we're going to induce, you have the option where we induce labor and you may be in labor for 36 hours, 72 hours, but no one can come visit you, or you can go for an elective C-section.
Mm.
For a moment, I was like, do I have to be that strong woman that goes through labor and like has a vaginal delivery?
Yeah.
Then I was actually, not, screw it. Yeah. I'm going to go, just cut me open, take the baby out, and that's it. But I understand what you mean, Karina, because this is how
we're in our culture. Yeah, and I just thought, you know, I thought in my head, I was like, someone from his family is going to say, well, we can find you a better woman. You know, we can find you someone who can give you those children, and we can find you someone who hasn't got that risk of cancer coming back, or, you know, looming over you for however many years. So it was really difficult. That was probably the first time when I was starting to worry about my own femininity and my own abilities as a woman. And then, of course, when I chose surrogacy, I had to just surrender to the fact that, you know, I had two options. One was to just wait it out and see if I ever could naturally be a mum, or B was to take positive action towards becoming a mum, but giving up all of those romantic, you know, things like the first kick and the knowing that, you know, and even now I write about it a lot, you know, knowing that my daughter doesn't know what I sound like from the inside. Like, my heartbeat wasn't the first heartbeat that she heard, and, you know, I've never known what she feels like inside me. And we never had those, you know, it probably isn't this romantic because I've not been there, but there's times where your bump grows and your husband's with you and he'll put his hand on your stomach, and, you know, you're both you'll both just be in awe at the fact
that's happened once to me, Karina, don't worry.
Yeah.
We literally have had no time for any of that. And it's only happened because I forced his hand on my tummy.
Yeah.
And said, feel your daughter.
Exactly. So, you know, I'm probably really romanticizing it because I lost it. But it was just all of, you know, letting go of that was a massive deal. And, you know, when I even say now to people who find themselves like at the door of surrogacy and who ask me for advice, the first thing I always say to them is that you have to be ready to give up a lot. And the thing is, it's not just that you give it up, but then when you're surrounded by people who are going through what you crave to go through and maybe don't show as much gratitude towards it as you wish they did. So, you know, if someone comes up and they're moaning about their, you know, someone once said to me, oh, at least you won't get swollen ankles. And I looked at them and I just thought, like, have you got any idea what it is to give it up? Because I'd do anything for swollen ankles right now, you know, because, you know, you take that because ultimately there is nothing more beautiful than bringing a life into this world, you know, and of course it'll be difficult. And of course, like you say, you might be sick and you might be tired and it'll be really strenuous. It'll just be really strenuous on your body. But, you know, I almost feel that as women, that's what we're programmed to do, you know, that.
Yeah, I think that's the beauty and the amazing thing about being a woman, that our bodies are capable of doing that, and it's something that we're capable of experiencing. And I think even I've had discussions with my husband, and he's a doctor as well. He's like, I just don't understand. It's like you're carrying a baby in a kangaroo pouch, and you're part of their growth, and you're growing them, and they're getting bigger within you, and they're connecting with you. And I understand what you're the point that you're trying to make, Karina, that it is, despite what our community says, whatever, it's something that we grow up as girls and think, oh, one day I'll have a little baby, I'll have a little bum. And it's something that we think about all the time. So I understand why that was difficult for you. But I also think that you were also quite fortunate, right? That you had this option Because there are lots of, you know, there are lots of other people around the world who may not have that access. And I think, you know, it's a beautiful thing in itself as well, in a separate way, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Like, pregnancy is one thing. Going through a pregnancy and growing your baby in your womb is a beautiful thing on its own. But I personally also think that surrogacy, where you can connect with another woman who can help you grow your family, is another beautiful thing in itself.
It is. And I say it now, like, it was difficult at the time when I had to, you know, when you're really vulnerable and you're having to give it up, of course it's difficult, but time heals. And by the time we came round to our surrogacy journey, you know, it couldn't have been more perfect. And I couldn't actually now imagine my daughter coming into the world in any other way, because this is what it was meant to be for us as a family. And I always say that she will, you know, I chose to undertake surrogacy here in England for a reason. So, at the time when we were looking, a lot of people used to say to me, go to India, because it was legal at that point to commercially, international couples could go to India for commercial surrogacy. It's not an option now, but back then it was. And they'd say, why don't you just go take your embryos there, and, you know, someone will be pregnant, and then 9 months later you can bring your baby home. And I was very much like, if I can't do this myself, I want to be in a place where I can be as close to someone who is doing it for me as possible. I wasn't ready to sort of let my child grow up overseas, you know, in someone else's womb, and then just pick them up. It wasn't for me. So we chose UK surrogacy, which is altruistic surrogacy. So people don't make a profit out of surrogacy in England. And it means that, because that's the way you do it, it's a longer process. Like, you don't just get matched with someone and then they have your baby. You have to form relationships and friendships, and so when I said, you know, I'd been part of these forums, I chose independent surrogacy, so I didn't go through an agency or anything like that. I just chose to do it myself, and found chat rooms and forums and secret groups actually on Facebook. So you know, I joined these communities and started letting people know who I was and what I was into. So I would just tell them a bit of my backstory, but equally I would let them know who I was as a person, because I am not cancer. You know, cancer doesn't define me. It's what brought me here, but there's a lot more to me than that. So I would tell them how I was like a crazy Take That fan, and like, you know, all these crazy things that I do in my life, and how, you know, my views are that, you know, everything happens for a reason, and, you know, I'm here for a reason. And just started getting to know people in that way. And then the lady who ultimately ended up being my surrogate, Ina, she contacted me, and she just said, oh, I've just, you know, been reading your posts, and I wondered if you wanted to chat and get to know each other. And I was like, yeah, cool. I've just had heart failure, and I was in Vancouver at this time, but yeah, let's carry on talking. And and she didn't, so I told her that I'd had heart failure and I was just in intensive care, and it didn't bother her. She was like, oh yeah, that's fine, we can still talk, can't we, because you'll get back. Like, she didn't for a minute think that I wasn't going to get home to England. And her hope gave me even more hope. And, you know, and she almost helped carry me home through some of the hardest, darkest times. And we basically came to England, her and I got to know each other. Then we got our husbands to meet each other, and our families got to know each other. We started going through agreements, which are sort of the framework that surrounds your surrogacy journey. And we just realized that we got on very well, and that this was hopefully going to work for all of us. And
your daughter is 2 years old now, right?
She is.
And are you still in touch with?
We are. Yeah, we are. We'll always be in touch. Like, so
is she part of your daughter's life now?
Or? So not actively, in that, you know, she doesn't come to my house all the time. But as example, when we had my daughter's first birthday party, she was there. When we have so with UK surrogacy, the person who gives birth to the child automatically goes on the birth certificate as the child's mother. So I wasn't actually legal mother when Amala was born. So we then had to go through family courts to apply for a parental order to have the birth certificate changed to my name. And that's a whole process in itself. But you know, all through that, she was by my side. And then when we went to court, she was down here the day before we went to court, and we had a date together. And, you know, every year we try, on my daughter's birthday, my surrogate lives in Bath, so we go up towards that part of the world, just so Amala's familiar with the town that she was born in. And we always meet up with her family. You know, we always stay in touch. We still WhatsApp each other, and we still know what's going on in each other's lives. And, you know, that was the reason I chose to do it here, because I want my daughter to know how she came to be. I don't ever want that to be a secret from her. I want her to know that, you know, this family who were once strangers had so much love for her mum and dad, and so much love to bring this child to life, that they themselves did it for us. You know, I just think, and like you say, you know, it is beautiful. So whilst giving birth to your own baby is incredible, actually someone giving birth to your child for you is just off the scale. You know, I always say that Amala is the result of science at its greatest and mankind at its finest, because the two of them together are what created her.
And I think there's a lot of sort of selflessness to some extent involved in doing that, because for me, Karina, I'm like, well, hell no, I'm doing 9 months of this. Right? And it's not easy to find someone who's willing and selfless to say, okay, you know, this is what I'll do for another family, because it is difficult. Because if you've gone through those 9 months, if she went through those 9 months with Amala in her womb, feeling her kicks, feeling her movements, there will be some connection, you know, in some form or another.
Yeah.
So to still be so supportive towards yourself and your husband, I think that really shows true strength of character. Oh, she's incredible.
You know, and every surrogate here in the UK who, and around the world, to be fair, who deliver babies to couples who can't do it themselves, are just incredible women, you know. They're there's no other word for them. You know, I just think she's just an angel, really. And, you know, even after Amala was born, I said to her, I said, how do you feel? You know, are you okay? Because it was really important that I supported her in whatever way I could. You know, she'd done this amazing thing for me, and all I could do was make sure she was okay. So I would say to her, are you okay? You know, how do you feel about her being, you know, with me now? And have you got any connection, or, you know, do you want anything? Do you need anything from me? And she just said, look, I just feel like I've given my best friend a baby. Like that's what I feel like. And she goes, and you don't need to worry about giving me anything, because all I need to do is see you as a family. And that is all that's you give me so much through that. Knowing that I'm the person who did that for you. So, you know, I think she will always be a part of, Amala's life, and you know, I can't ever see that changing, and I'll make sure that my daughter knows that mummy's tummy was broken, but someone else grew you.
Well, Karina, I could go on talking to you forever. This conversation is really interesting, and I think there's so much more we can talk about. We may actually, I would like to just have a part two with you.
I think we'll have to.
We need to, because there is some more I want to go into. Because there is more to your story.
There is.
You are expecting twins, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, so you are expecting twins. So I'm going to leave that as the cliffhanger. And when I'm ready to come back after giving birth, then we can talk about it. Because it might go on for hours.
Yeah.
I don't have any problem with that.
No. It's just,
the podcasting world doesn't work like that. So
I think that's literally two parts.
Yeah, we'll do it in two parts, Karina, definitely. But I just want to ask you one thing before I go, Karina, and that is, what is one thing you tell yourself every morning when you wake up?
I tell myself I am enough. You know, I'm enough, and that's all I ever need to be. I don't need to be more than that, and I'll never be less than that. So,
I think, Karina, you've told such a beautiful story, and I have a lot to think about now as well. And I think your story can help so many people across the UK and across the world. And I'm sure even part two will give us more insight into what it's been like. But thank you again for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's taken some time for us to go back and forth, but we did it. And now we'll definitely have a part two, because I want to know as well what's been happening with this next chapter, new chapter of your life as well. So I'll see you next time. Hopefully, maybe the baby will be either with me or crying somewhere. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen, but we'll figure it out. We'll make it work.
For sure. I look forward to it.
Thank you, Karina. And I'll see you very soon.
Thanks, Min. I'll see you later.
And thank you, Karina, for joining me again. Thank you for sharing your story. I had goosebumps throughout the whole thing. And I can't wait to hear about your future plans with your future additions to your family and what that's been like, because I'm sure that's been a very different experience, especially through a pandemic. It'll be very interesting to see what you went through. And I also want to talk to Karina more about the psychological side of waking up every morning and knowing that, well, things are going to be quite different for her family. Things might always change. And I saw yesterday, Karina went on a 6 a.m. run. And I'm just like, this woman just doesn't stop. She is the definition of strength and power and determination. And I really, really admire that. And this is what I love about this podcast, is that we're building a community of people who inspire, who show this courage and strength, because this is what this is about, that we speak up. We learn, we help each other, and I hope to continue to do that with all of you. So Karina's next part hopefully will come out in the next week or so. I hope that everybody understands that I am very close to my delivery date, so I hope that people can just sort of hold on and just bear with me and be patient. I'm sure that once the baby comes, it could go either way, either I just get too sleep deprived and I will be able to even pick up a microphone, or having a baby might mean that I might just get my shit together and actually be more military with my schedule. So let's see what happens either way. But you can follow all updates on my Instagram, Meenal's World. You can follow Karina as well on Instagram. I'll leave her Instagram handle in the show notes, and hope to see you all very soon, maybe with a baby, who knows. So until next week, I'm Meenal, and big, big hug to everybody who's been messaging, and I hope everybody's slowly coming out of the pandemic mode and trying to get back to normal life. So I'll see you all very soon, hopefully.